Welcome to today's JNEB webinar. Happy to have everyone here today. So glad we can get together virtually, if nothing else. My name's Rachel Dager. I'm the Executive Director of SNEB. And a little bit of housekeeping to get us started. If you look in the GoToWebinar tool panel, you'll see handouts. And so the slides for today's presentations are there for you to download and take notes and follow along. We'll take questions at the end of the presentation. So please put those in the question block and we will moderate those to our presenters. When the webinar ends today, you'll be prompted to complete a short survey. Please take a moment to give feedback on this webinar as well as ideas for future Journal Club sessions. And then this webinar is being recorded. Will be available on the SNEB website by the middle of the week, but then we'll also send an email out by Wednesday of this week with a link to the recording, the slide handout, as well as the CU certificate that you're earning for your attendance today. I will hand things over to our moderator. Dr. Kristen DiFilippo is an assistant teaching professor at the University of Illinois.
Hi, everybody. It's great to connect with you today virtually. Today, our speakers for the Journal Club are, first of all, Elizabeth Kroger. She is a registered dietitian and course instructor in the Department of Nutrition Sciences at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Her research uses both qualitative and quantitative methods and focuses on assessing diet quality to inform community-based nutrition interventions. Dr. Schneider-Worthington is a postdoctoral researcher in the Division of Preventive Medicine at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. She is a registered dietitian with a particular interest in understanding the role of modifiable prenatal and early postnatal factors on the developmental origins of childhood obesity and using observational quantitative and qualitative research to inform novel interventions for preventing obesity and associated comorbidities from conception. I so appreciate them being here today, and I really look forward to their presentation and thank them for sharing their expertise. As they're speaking, if you can enter any questions into the question box, I will moderate those questions to them at the end. At this point, I can hand it over to Elizabeth.
That sounds good. Today we will be talking about reasons for late night eating and willingness to change, a qualitative study in pregnant Black women. I will say Camille, the other presenter, is having a little trouble connecting right now, but I am going to go ahead and do her part. And as soon as she can log back in, then I will go ahead and transfer it back over to her. But for now, we will just continue as normal. So to give you an outline of what we're going to be talking about, we'll first go into an introduction, talk about some objectives of the study, talk about the methodology, the results, discussion, and then implications for practice and research. So as many of you are probably aware, obesity continues to be a major public health concern. And as you can see here, in the U.S., about 50% of white women are overweight and obese prior to becoming pregnant. Among Black women, the prevalence of pre-pregnancy overweight and obesity is even higher at over 60%. So there's definitely a disparity that exists here. So this is extremely concerning as maternal obesity is associated with various complications, including impaired glucose tolerance and fetal macrosomia. Additionally, in the long term, children born to mothers with obesity have a 2 to 4-fold increase of overweight and obesity across childhood from the ages of 2 to 18 years old. And this increased risk of macrosomia and future obesity is believed to be at least partially attributable to the delivery of excess fuel across the placenta. As pregnancy progresses, insulin sensitivity decreases and glucose concentrations increase. Obesity exacerbates this problem whereby mothers with obesity have poorer insulin sensitivity in late pregnancy compared to normal weight mothers, thereby increasing the potential for elevated glucose and triglyceride concentrations an increased delivery of fuel to the fetus, which in turn programs fetal metabolism in a manner that promotes weight gain and adiposity. And consequently, maternal obesity is a significant driver of the intergenerational transmission of obesity. So ideally, we would be able to intervene prior to pregnancy to help women achieve a healthy weight. However, this is not feasible given that about half of all pregnancies in the U.S. are unplanned. Thus, the next best approach would be to intervene during pregnancy to minimize impairments in insulin sensitivity and glucose tolerance among obese mothers. Research concerning the influence of free-living diet on glucose tolerance during pregnancy has failed to reach a consensus. In a meta-analysis of interventions to prevent gestational diabetes, Ustam and colleagues found no clear advantage of either of the most common interventions, which were to reduce the intake of fat or to reduce the intake of carbohydrate and glycemic index foods. However, there is an increasing evidence that aside from macronutrient distribution, the timing of energy intake may be an important factor influencing glucose tolerance and adiposity. So there is increasing evidence that the timing of food intake may play a role in weight gain and metabolic health. Many of our body's processes display natural 24-hour cycles or rhythms across the day, referred to as circadian rhythms. So as a result of these rhythms, we may feel more energized during certain times of the day. Research shows that many of our anabolic rhythms peak during the morning to noon. For instance, it's constantly been demonstrated that glucose tolerance is significantly better in the morning compared to the evening. Additionally, thermic effect of food is up to 44% higher following meals consumed in the morning versus those consumed in the evening. Based on these biological rhythms, earlier in the day, it's more optimal for food intake, whereas the nighttime is optimal for sleeping and fasting. And this is evidenced by research showing the adverse metabolic consequences of shift work. So additionally, in non-pregnant healthy adults, there's a consistent evidence that insulin sensitivity is impaired in the evening relative to the morning, and glucose concentrations are higher following meals identical in composition consumed in the evening versus the morning. Thus, late day energy consumption may be detrimental to glucose tolerance. So due to the decline in insulin sensitivity across pregnancy, meal timing may be especially important as late night carbohydrate consumption could be more taxing on beta cells due to reduced insulin sensitivity late in the day. And as such, to our knowledge, our lab was the first to examine association of late night energy and carbohydrate intake with glucose tolerance in pregnancy. And we did this in a cohort of low-income African-American women during the third trimester of pregnancy, as this is a group with an elevated risk of obesity and associated comorbidity. So with this study, Camila's back, so I will let her continue this slide.
Yeah, sorry. So can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Perfect. As Lizzie was saying, due to the decline in insulin sensitivity across pregnancy, meal timing may be especially important as late night carb consumption could be more taxing on pancreatic beta cells due to the reduced insulin sensitivity late in the day. And so to our knowledge, our lab was the first to examine the association of late night energy and carbohydrate intake with glucose tolerance in pregnancy. And we did this in a cohort of low-income African-American women during the third trimester of pregnancy, as this is a group with an elevated risk of obesity and associated comorbidities. And so ultimately, we found that food and beverage consumption between the hours of 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. was very prevalent in this cohort. All but one woman reported energy intake on at least one of the days that women kept food records. And about a quarter of daily energy intake during the third trimester of pregnancy was consumed at night, which we defined as between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. in this cohort. We ran analyses stratified by maternal early pregnancy BMI. So when we looked at women with normal weight in early pregnancy, neither late night energy nor carbohydrate intake were associated with glucose or insulin sensitivity. However, in women with obesity in early pregnancy, we did find that late night energy, and in particular late night carbohydrate intake, was associated with greater glucose concentrations after a 75 gram oral glucose tolerance test, but less ability of insulin secretion to compensate for reduced insulin sensitivity and lower insulin secretion. When we looked at daytime energy and carbohydrate intake, we did not see any association with indices of glucose tolerance or insulin action. And so what we concluded was that among women with obesity, late night eating appears to potentially impair glucose tolerance in late pregnancy and could potentially play a role in fetal programming. And these findings were really, really exciting for us. Late night eating could be a potential novel intervention target for improving maternal child health. And as much as we wanted to just jump right in and go straight to the intervention study, we really had to make sure that we were not getting ahead of ourselves and skipping important steps that we needed before we could actually conduct an intervention trial. There we go. So, one thing we realized when we took a step back was that there were a lot of unanswered questions and factors that we needed to understand before we could pursue an intervention study, like why women were engaging in late night eating during pregnancy in this population. Would they be willing to change this behavior? An intervention could be really difficult if this isn't something women were open to changing. What barriers exist for changing this behavior? And also, would women be accepting of low glycemic index snack alternatives? We were interested in this question because foods with a high glycemic index are potentially more detrimental because they generate a larger increase in circulating glucose concentration compared to those foods with a lower glycemic index. And so ultimately, this is what led us to the next chapter in this research story, which was to conduct a qualitative study to answer these questions, and ultimately what led to the paper published in the Journal of Nutrition, Education, and Behavior. So the overall goals of the qualitative study we're going to talk about today were to identify the individual and interpersonal influences on late night caloric intake among Black women with pre-pregnancy overweight or obesity. We also examined women's attitudes and perceptions about changing this behavior, and then wanted to understand women's perceptions and acceptance of lower glycemic index food and beverage alternatives. So I will turn it over back over to Lizzie, and she'll talk about the methodology we use to address these goals.
Yeah, so before I actually go into talking about the methods of the study, I do want to mention that Dr. Snyder and Chandler Laney's labs were the masterminds behind this project. So they performed studies which answered some questions and then brought to light some new ones, ones that were best answered through qualitative research methods. And then when they realized this, they pulled myself and Dr. Brenda Bertrand, who was my mentor for my PhD, which I finished 3 weeks ago, but into this picture. And since we're sort of like the go-to qualitative researchers in the department, that's why they pulled us into it. So I thought that this research product was just a really neat example of how research should be done, in that you have a relevant research question, then you figure out the best way to answer it. And in this case, it was through the use of qualitative methods, and a natural collaboration then was formed when they brought us in to help with the design, implementation, and analysis of this study. That is what I will talk about. So in order to achieve the goals of this study, we recruited participants from the UAB Obstetrics Clinic. And at this clinic, nurses reviewed medical charts to identify patients who met eligibility requirements, which included Black women over the age of 18 years or older. They were in their third trimester of pregnancy and had a BMI between 25 and 45.9 kilograms per meter squared at their first prenatal visit. The one thing I also want to note is that participants received their care during their pregnancies at this clinic, so they're familiar with this clinic and the staff at this clinic. So when those women who met eligibility requirements were called via phone and asked if they ate between the hours of 8 p.m. and 6 a.m., and if they did and it was not contributed to late night shift work or late shift work, then they were asked if they would like to participate in the study. And one thing I should also mention is that when we recruited participants, we did tell them that childcare would be provided during the time of data collection and that they would be financially compensated for their time and travel to the clinic. And then if they agreed to participate, then we scheduled a time to come into the clinic for data collection. So I first want to provide an overview of the data collection methods used for this study. All data collection procedures occurred at the UAB Obstetrics Clinic, where the participants were familiar with, because this is where they received their care, as I mentioned. So when participants arrived at this clinic during their scheduled time, a research assistant met with them at the entrance of the building, and if they brought children, then the children remained in the lobby. We had blocks and toys, things for them to do, with two members of the research team, while another member of the research team brought the mother back to the meeting room. And while in the meeting room, the participants took part in a one-hour focus group and completed a demographic questionnaire. And then we also collected some information about clinical characteristics of the mother. So as I mentioned, we conducted focus groups with the participants to see, and the goal of these focus groups was informed through the previous studies, where we wanted to explore shared experiences and perceptions of late night eating among the participant population we were already working with at this clinic. And in order to achieve this goal, we thought that 3 to 4 focus groups comprised of about 6 to 8 participants would be sufficient, and this was based on recommendations from the literature. We also audio recorded in these focus group interviews and had a note taker present. And the note taker and the moderator, one important thing to note, they matched the race of the participants in order to promote openness during these discussions. So the moderator had previous training and experience moderating focus groups. She used a semi-structured interview script, which meant that she had a list of questions, but the questions could change if the conversation within the focus group naturally shifted away from the script. It was just meant to guide the discussion. And then the questions on this interview script were developed by the PI, who has, as you've heard, has lots of experience with the population at this clinic and with the content of the topic. And then in addition, the script was reviewed for content and clarity by 2 other researchers who also had experience in this population. So this is what the semi-structured interview script looked like in the sense of the questions that were asked to the participants and guided the discussion. Some of these questions included, did you eat or drink after 8 p.m. before you were pregnant, or is this something that you started only with this pregnancy? What types of things do you normally typically eat and drink after 8 p.m.? Why do you choose to eat those items at night? If you found out that eating late at night was bad for your health or could be bad for your baby's health, would you try and stop eating at night? But then another thing that I haven't mentioned yet is that a secondary question of this study was to understand their perceptions of a proposed intervention to modify late night food and beverage choices. So we wanted to understand what types of food and beverages lower on the glycemic index than the ones that they were currently eating, this population would be willing to accept. So some of the questions like lower glycemic index foods were offered to you to try during the interview today. What do you think about the foods we had available for you to eat? These were directly asking about the buffet style food and beverages that were offered to the women before, during, and at the end of the focus group. So the goal of this was to identify potential lower glycemic index food and beverages that could replace those that our previous studies have identified this population already consuming at night. So we took that information and a registered dietitian identified potential alternatives to those food and beverage items currently consumed at night and developed alternatives that were lower on the glycemic index. However, I will mention these items that the registered dietitian came up with for them to try weren't necessarily low glycemic index items. They were just lower than what was previously reported as being consumed. So for example, we knew that participants at this clinic like to drink soda during the night hours. So we provided different types of diet sodas on the buffet line to see what they thought about that switch. Another example were apples. Apples are great, healthy to eat. We always encourage them to eat those items. However, in the night hours, maybe swapping to watermelon, which is lower on the glycemic index, and seeing how they accepted watermelon. So here I'm showing you how the buffet looked in the meeting room where the focus group interviews took place. The food and beverage items were set out on tables and everything was labeled. So there was no question of what's this? Should I try this? Because I don't know what it is. Everyone knew clearly what it was. In addition, women were encouraged to help themselves anything they'd like before, during, or after the interviews. And then they're also told to eat as little or much as they wanted. So we'll talk about the food and beverage items provided in a little bit more detail later, but just so you have a good idea of what types of foods were offered, we had chicken nuggets, diet sodas, water flavor packs like Crystal Light. We had a few different flavors, which you can see on the table. We had sparkling water, flat water, veggie trays, fruits, trail mixes, turkey and cheese wraps, vegetables, and then we also had some different dipping options. So as I mentioned, the moderator solicited feedback from the participants about their acceptance of the food and beverages offered. And those items that were liked by the majority were served for the next focus group. And then those that were disliked were swapped for a similar item, which was identified by a registered dietitian. So for example, participants didn't like the diet soda option. So for the next focus group interview, we tried sparkling water. Still has that bubbly feel, but some of the sparkling water options don't have that artificial sweetener taste that's so potent in diet sodas. So then we offered the sparkling water option for the next focus group. And at the end of the focus groups, participants completed the Hollingshead four-factor index of social status, which is a survey designed to measure social status of an individual based on four domains, which are marital status, retired employment status, educational attainment, and occupational prestige. And then, in addition, clinical characteristics from the medical charts were obtained, which included age, weight, gestational weeks at the time of study, gravidity, and parity. So immediately following the focus groups, after the participants left, the note taker and moderator stayed in the meeting room to debrief, where they discussed the topics that were brought up in the focus group when the discussion was still fresh in their minds. And the point of this really was to determine if the interview script needed to be changed, because remember, with qualitative research, you want to let the participants' natural discussion guide what questions you're asking, because the point is to better understand their perceptions of the topic and not your own. But since no new topics were brought up that were not included in the interview script, no changes were made to those to that interview script. And we completed the focus groups until saturation was met and no new information was brought up during the focus group interviews. In other words, the focus group discussions became very repetitive, which is good. We saw saturation occur after the second focus group, as no new information was brought up that was not brought up in that first interview. However, we went ahead and ran that third focus group just to confirm saturation. And again, no new themes were identified. Which is when we concluded data collection for the focus groups. So next, talking about how we analyzed our qualitative data, we of course used a coding process. So in order to do so, we transcribed the audio recordings of the focus group interviews verbatim, meaning every word the participants and moderator said we included in the transcriptions, actually typed out. We conducted content checking several times to ensure that we had correctly transcribed the audio recordings. We also removed identifiers, so if the participants mentioned any names or identifiable information, we also removed that. And then we uploaded those transcripts to NVivo, which is a qualitative research computer software program. And the next thing we did was we began coding the transcripts. So for this, we had two separate coders who on their own analyzed each of the three focus group transcripts and coded those. So for those who may not be familiar, as familiar with qualitative research, when we're coding, we read through those transcripts using the participants' direct quotes to identify common themes of the focus group discussions. And these common themes are called codes. So when we do this, we also develop a codebook, which I show here, and this keeps track of the identified themes, including the abbreviation of the code, code name, definition of the code, provide the description of it, criteria for when the code applies, and also for when it does not apply. So for each of the two coders coding separately, they developed their own code book. And then once this was complete, the two coders came together with the PI to develop a final code book. And we did this through a consensual process, meaning everyone had to agree upon the code in order for it to be included in that final code book that we developed. And once we developed that final code book, then we had the moderator and the note taker review this, as they were actually in the sessions, the focus group sessions, to make sure that those themes or codes that we identified were true to the conversations that occurred during those focus groups. And so the qualitative data reported in the results includes the final codes that came from the focus group interviews and direct quotes from the participants that supports or provides evidence for those codes that we identified. So moving on to the results. For the demographic and clinical characteristics of the participants in the study, the mean age was 26 years old, mean BMI was 33, gravidity, which is the number of times the women have been pregnant, was about 3, and the parity, which is the number of times the woman has actually given birth, was about 1. In addition, the average number of adults in the home was about 2, and average number of children in the home was also about 2. So moving on to the findings from the focus groups, we ended up running 3 focus group interviews, all of which had between 4 and 8 participants. So we had 16 participants total. And we identified 4 main themes or 4 apparent themes from these discussions, which included reasons for late night eating, late night food choices, willingness to change late night eating, and food buffet feedback. So we're going to take a deeper look into each one of these. So the first theme identified included the reasons for late night eating, which participants described why they engaged in eating specifically between those hours of 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. So the reasons participants gave for late night eating included both individual reasons, meaning it was them or the fetus in them that was causing them to eat during these hours, And then they also provided interpersonal reasons, which was contributed to others in the household or around the participants that the participants identified as being the reason that they engaged in late night eating. So taking a look at the individual reasons that participants identified as late reasons for late night eating were identified mainly as physiological reasons. So looking at this hunger point, the first reason that participants were engaging in late night eating was simply for hunger, which is due to the fact that they did not get that full feeling that they typically did because of their pregnancy. And therefore, they weren't eating as much in a single meal, causing them to wake up hungry in the middle of the night. So one participant said, "I do not ever get that full feeling like I was before I was pregnant. I'm constantly eating, but I'm still hungry." Another participant said, "I want something to eat at like 2 or 3 in the morning. That's when I'm really hungry, and I actually eat at that time." Altered sleep schedules was another reason participants stated they ate late at night. And these altered sleep schedules were contributed to two things. The first was that participants identified having trouble sleeping. They couldn't get comfortable because of their pregnancy and therefore ended up falling asleep later, which caused them to sleep in later the next morning then. And then sleeping in later meant that they ate a later breakfast, which then shifted the meal times for the rest of the day, ultimately causing their last meal to be later in the evening. So one participant said, "I sleep the majority of the morning because I toss and turn the majority of the night anyways. So that is why I sleep so late. And then when I do get up, I'm on the go and I don't think about eating." Fetal movement at night was another reason participants had altered sleep schedules, which they identified as a reason for late night eating. And mothers interpreted this movement in the middle of the night as the fetus being hungry. So they would eat in order to soothe the fetus. So one mother said, "I think my baby lets me know when she's hungry. She like makes some hunger noises. I'm like, okay, I'm about to get up. Just hold on a minute." Another mother said, "Oh, they wake you up. I eat whenever the baby says get up." And then lastly, nausea was identified as a reason for late night eating. And this was for two different reasons. The first was that participants identified morning nausea made them not hungry in the early morning hours. And similar to the altered sleep schedule, it shifted their eating patterns. And the participant didn't have their first meal until later in the day, which meant that their last eating of the day occurred later. One participant said, "My first trimester, I was real sick. And then after that, about 2 or 3 in the morning, I'm starved out. And now I've got a bag that sits on the side of my bed, like Little Debbie snack cakes, because I just reach over just something to put in my mouth and soothe." And then the second reason nausea was also identified as a reason for late night eating was because participants found consistent eating about every 2 hours helped avoid nausea for them. So for this reason, they would wake up in the middle of the night to eat something about every 2 hours just to avoid that nausea. And one participant said, "If I go longer than 2 hours, I get so nauseated. So it's like I have to write on the hour and 45 minutes, we need to find something to eat." So moving on to interpersonal reasons for late night eating, participants identified others in the household as triggering them to eat late at night. Sort of like, if they're eating, I'm going to eat. I'm going to eat because they're eating, sort of thing. One participant said, "Because my mom sitting here all night too, we just be eating together." And then another participant said, "As long as I hear him eating, I'm going to eat." Another interpersonal reason for late night eating was that participants chose to eat specific foods late at night, so they didn't have to share them with others in the household, as they would eat them while others were sleeping, which I thought was kind of an interesting point. One participant said, "I eat dinner and then late night snacks. I do not really have to share with my children, so I can eat all of it. So it's a perfect time. And then another said, I have a snack closet, I'm going to be honest, in my room. So whenever I want, I can just open the closet and take it, actually hide it from my children. And as the youngest child of three, I can relate to that. So the next identified theme focused on the food choices that participants stated they ate, that they eat when they do engage in late night eating. And these food choices were mainly processed foods that were energy dense and nutrient poor. So some examples that they provided were cereal, ice cream, candy bars, ham sandwiches, snack cakes, juice, soda, water, that sort of thing. Some also mentioned foods that they would not choose to eat at night, which included fried foods, and they contributed that to causing heartburn. But I will say that this wasn't mentioned by all the participants, but some did mention foods that they would not eat. Also, participants talked about what drove them to choose these types of foods. Mainly taste, accessibility, and convenience were the drivers of the foods that were ultimately chosen to consume, with one participant saying, it is just at night, they're half asleep anyways, so something that I can just quickly grab and don't have to do too much for. So the next theme identified from the focus group discussions was willingness to change, where the participants described how open or not open they would be to making these changes to their current late night eating habits. So with this theme, it's important to note that a lot of the discussion specifically came from the question within that interview guide, which asked, if you found out that eating late at night was bad for your health or could be bad for your baby's health, would you try and stop eating at night? And some of the participants said quickly, without hesitation, that they would attempt to make the change as it wouldn't be that hard to do. They kind of just shrugged it off. Not a big deal to make that change. And then they naturally went into a discussion about how they would do this, talking about how they would just eat earlier or they would go to sleep earlier, but basically saying that it wouldn't be that big of a deal for them to make this change. And then other participants identified this being a little bit harder to do as they formed this habit, and it's not something that you can just change overnight. And one participant said, I mean, I care about my baby, don't get me wrong, but it's like once you get used to doing something, it's kind of hard to break out of. And after some expressed some concern about making these changes, a natural conversation stemmed, which focused on what it would take to make these changes. And it depended on the perceived seriousness of the health impact on the child. But I do want to mention, though, that none of the women said anything about their own health in this conversation. Their main focus was on the health of their baby. And so I thought that was an interesting point, is that their baby was their number one concern. But the perceived health impact on the child depended on whether these changes would be considered or not. So things like the baby being obese was a health concern that could be worked through using other techniques rather than changing their late night eating. So as one mother mentioned, like an obese child, we can work on that. And then other health impacts on the infant perceived to be more serious would inspire changes without hesitation. As one participant stated, birth defects, any heart problems, other things that would require hospitalization or a handicap, these problems would be serious enough to inspire those changes. And then from this discussion, the moderator included a follow-up question, which was, is there anything other than a health concern that would encourage you to change your late night eating habits? And some of the mothers stated financial incentives would be a motivator. One person said, if they say $5 a night, if you don't eat at 2 or 3 in the morning, I'll give you $5 every day if you do not do it, then they might consider not eating late at night. So this discussion about financial incentives really drove the next question about monetary barriers to making this change to not eating the foods that they're currently eating at night. As participants identified fruit, an item that they perceived to be an acceptable alternative to include in these late night eating habits as being inexpensive to what they're currently eating. However, the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children was one program identified as helping with this identified barrier and helping alleviate some of this burden of the perceived monetary barriers. So one participant actually talks about her experiences with this program and says with that $10, she can get some plums, grapes, strawberries, and she's happy by the time they bring it up. It'll probably be about, it's never the whole amount, and that'll last her for the next month because she'll just nibble on it and keep nibbling. It also helps her get her fruit because other than that, she's just not going to go into the store and buy fruit. And then another barrier to making this change to late night eating habits included preferences, as participants weren't sure what they would be willing to change, what they were currently eating for food and beverages considered to be lower glycemic index foods. So it's important to note here that we did not have a conversation with the participants about what these lower glycemic index food and beverage items would be that we would ultimately suggest in the future that they would swap out. And so discussions centered around what they perceived these food and beverages to be. However, if they didn't like the food and beverage items that they would be talking about changing to eating late at night, they perceived this being a barrier to making this change. So one participant said, I think one of the challenges would be is if I didn't like what I had to change it to, which makes sense. But that leads us to the question of what are some of these lower glycemic index food and beverage items that participants may be willing to swap out for with what they're currently consuming late at night, which naturally leads us to the food buffet. If you remember, we provided participants with food and beverage items that were lower on the glycemic index than what a previous study with this clinic population identified them currently eating. And participants were encouraged to consume however little or much they wanted before, during, and after these focus group interviews. And the last questions on the interview script included questions about the food and beverages provided on the buffet to understand what foods were and were not accepted. So to acclimate you to this chart or this table here, you can see the columns here are focus group 1, 2, and 3. And these are the foods that we offered within each focus group. And if you remember, if they liked the food, then we provided that food item again. And if they did not like that food, we swapped it out with a similar type of food item. So first, just some general feedback about the buffet. We noticed that most of the participants chose to not consume the food during the focus group, but rather they prepared a plate to take home with them. And this could have been due to the time of the interviews. Typically, we had these interviews about mid-morning. And so most of the participants had mentioned that they came in just having had a snack or breakfast. And then in addition, as you may expect, everyone has different food preferences, which isn't necessarily groundbreaking, but hummus was an example of that. So you can see some participants said, I eat the hummus, I'd like it. And then others said things like lose the hummus. But the important thing to note with this one is that everyone did find at least a couple items within this list of food that they did identify as enjoying. So those food and beverage items that were most accepted included the chicken salad, nut mix, pepperonis, a lot of the fruits, chicken, sliced cucumbers, the water and Crystal Light. Those are the two beverage accepted items. And then to me, I thought this part was kind of interesting. Those least accepted items really focused around the drinks. So it was those diet sodas, Diet Mountain Dew, which is a big thing here in this state. And then the sparkling waters. So they did not like these items. They preferred Crystal Light and water. but the reasons that they disliked these drinks differed, which I thought was interesting. Some just didn't like the taste of diet drinks. They're perceived as having that artificial taste. Some didn't want soda at all because it was just too sweet. And some contributed to causing heartburn. So the feedback about the drinks were pretty consistent among the participants. Really just wanted Crystal Light or water. And then participants also brought up hesitancy about trying new to them food items. Hummus was a common one again, some liking, some not. But the point being that it may have taken a little convincing or having others within the group trying it first to get them to actually go and try that food item. There's a lot of discussion of if the food and beverage item caused heartburn, which played a large role in the participant accepting the item or not. So even if the participant may like the taste of the item, they might not accept it if it did cause heartburn. And then lastly, as one of my guests, there's also a discussion about what items were missing from the buffet, with participants really suggesting items of what to include on the next one, mentioning things that are higher on the glycemic index, like pizza, breads, and crackers.
All right. So overall, just to summarize a lot of what Lizzie just went over and laid out so wonderfully, there were a diverse set of reasons for engaging in late night eating in this population. These range from individual, physiological, and non-physiological contributors, as well as the influence of others in the household. There were also differences in barriers among women. And so together, this suggests that it may be important to tailor interventions to address the contributors and barriers that are unique to each woman to help change late night eating habits. Women's comments about food choices pretty consistently focused on taste, accessibility, and convenience. And this is really important to consider for any future intervention because possible replacements will sort of need to meet these criteria. So avoiding low glycemic index options that require a lot of preparation, potentially avoiding alternatives that require refrigeration. As some participants mentioned, they would keep the late night snacks that they were consuming on their nightstand or on the floor next to their bed. And so those obviously were options that weren't refrigerated. But we were encouraged that at least most women found a few lower glycemic index options that they liked that were included as part of the buffet. And there also was a spectrum regarding the willingness to change, with some women saying they felt that they could and would be able to change this behavior by just going to bed earlier, whereas others were a little more hesitant. So consistent with the health belief model, some women commented that they were willing to change their late night eating if there was a cue to action. In this case, what was specifically mentioned was having a doctor suggest that they refrain from or change their late night eating habits. Others expressed a need to evaluate the severity of any health concern for them that may exist and be related to late night eating, and to weigh that against their perceived costs or barriers of changing their late night eating. So altogether, by and large, it was pretty clear that most women in this population were not aware of the potential adverse health consequences that might be attributed to late night eating. And so again, it may be important for future interventions to include some sort of educational component to help make women aware of the potential health consequences for them and their fetus of late night eating.
So applying these findings to practice, these findings can be useful for practitioners and researchers. So we identified reasons or potential reasons and barriers for late night eating during pregnancy, which can inform the approach that practitioners take with their patients and also inform future research of intervention strategies, specifically suggesting the potential need to address physiological reasons for late night eating. It may also include, like Camille said, some education about consequences of late night eating, and should also include and consider some of those barriers of making those changes to these late night eating habits. And then further, we were able to identify some lower glycemic index food and beverage alternatives that may be accepted in order to make those changes to their current late night eating habits. So starting to wrap things up, there were some strengths and limitations to this study, as with any. First, this study was novel in the fact that we provided lower glycemic index foods in the buffet form to participants, which really allowed a natural conversation to occur and allowed us to receive their feedback about which items were accepted and which ones weren't. Also, the focus group discussions centered around a single health behavior, which was late night eating. So it was really focused. And then lastly, the moderator and note taker were the same race as participants, which has been shown to promote comfort and openness during discussions. For the limitations of the study, participants in the study were not screened for night eating syndrome, or NES, which is a nocturnal loss of control. It's classified as a binge eating disorder. And some studies suggest that NES may have a hormonal connection, but it's currently unknown whether hormonal changes during pregnancy may increase the risk for this. So really, future studies should distinguish between habitual nighttime eating from this disordered binge eating. In addition, we had a small sample size of 16 participants. However, this is considered to be a typical sample size for qualitative research methods. And then lastly, because of the homogeneous population and the fact that qualitative findings are only representative of those participants that were involved in the study, findings from the study aren't generalizable to the entire population. However, findings from the study do inform the need for future intervention studies related to late night eating in this population.
So, to conclude, we wanted to illustrate sort of the big overall story and the journey we took to get to this publication and where we're going next. This really started with that observational quantitative cohort study where we found that late night carbohydrate intake may be an important factor influencing glucose tolerance among obese pregnant women and may be a novel intervention target. This then led us to the quantitative study, which was published in the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior, that really we used to build on the initial study to get a better understanding of why women were engaging in this behavior, what barriers may exist, what they look for when making late night food choices, and whether they would be willing to change. And this is all important. And really together, we're planning to use the information from both studies to then go to the next chapter in this research story, which is to develop and test an intervention aimed at nighttime eating. So encouraging women to refrain from nighttime eating, and if they are going to eat late at night, providing lower glycemic index alternatives and to see what effect this may have on maternal metabolic health and child health. And we're also excited because we think this information could be useful for other investigators to also explore new and exciting questions related to nighttime eating in this population as well as others.
So in conclusion, we have some people that we definitely want to thank for this. Of course, all of our co-authors, specifically Paula Chandler Laney, who was the PI of this study. Also, those who helped us with recruitment and administration support. Of course, we want to thank the the participants of this study who allowed us to work with them and who spent time coming into the facility. And then we also should mention that this study was supported by two grants with the National Institutes of Diabetes, Digestive, and Kidney Diseases of Health. So with that, we will go to questions.
Thank you so much for sharing. That was a great study and studies to hear about. So I know we're running close on time, but one question we did have is, were you able to identify any differences in eating based on time of night? For example, did late night eating look different if it was before they went to bed versus waking during the middle of the night?
That is a very good question. That isn't something that we had specifically looked at, but is something that we could try to gauge. We didn't have any sort of like sleep records, so we don't necessarily know when women were going to sleep and waking, but I think that's an interesting question and something that would be worth looking at in future studies for sure, is that impact of whether they're eating before they go to sleep or after they're waking up overnight. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and because it is 1 o'clock, I want to say thank you again for sharing your research and pass it back to Rachel.
Yes, thank you very much. Very interesting. Please complete the survey you received when I close out the webinar. Watch for an email on Wednesday with today's recording, as well as your CEU certificate and the handouts. And then we will be back again next Monday for the next session of Journal Club, and hope to see you then. Thank you.